I'm Jeff Booth, and this is Sex Science Sunday here on the Jeff Booth Show, brought to you by the Center for Sexual Expression and Education. So, swipe left, swipe right, does it even matter? Is Tinder and similar dating apps, are they even worth it? According to research done by postdoctoral fellow Trond Viggo Grundtvedt at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, he is the first author of an article in Evolutionary Psychological Science, and if you listen to the show a lot of times, you might know that we are not huge fans of evolutionary psychology and question its methodologies and assumptions and conclusions. The article focused on Tinder, and what he concluded is that for people who actually have sexual relations outside Tinder, Tinder use only provides a limited increase in the number of one-night stands. I guess that would sort of depend on what you consider a limited increase. I know for a lot of men, one, that would be an increase that they would be thrilled with. So basically their conclusions were not that surprising. They said most of the people who succeed on Tinder have casual sex and hookups otherwise, too. And they said that we have found little reason to claim that dating apps lead to more short-term sexual relationships than before. Based on their research, swiping left or right is not a shortcut, and that people will probably succeed just as well by meeting live people. They did find that men and women use Tinder differently. Most women take time to evaluate their potential matches, and they're typically looking for a relationship, whereas men are quicker in their assessments and swipe to the right far more often in the hope that a high enough number will result in at least one hit. So in their study, they found that about 20% of users were able to successfully have a one-night stand after using Tinder. But the vast majority of these only had this happen once. 80% of the users don't have any sex at all. So while Tinder may offer new sexual opportunities, it's not a lot. As you might guess, the people who tend to be most successful on Tinder are those who are most successful anyway in terms of attracting others because they're already very physically attractive. And as this and other studies have shown, Tinder is not an effective way to meet a potential long-term partner. The study included 269 study participants, and 62% of them were women. As is so often the case in university studies, they were university students, but at least in this case, they were in the appropriate demographic. But you can't really extrapolate beyond college students. This is the same is true of many, many studies done at colleges that only involve college students. It's not enough of a sample to really get a fair look at the population as a whole. Understanding homosexuality is a conundrum, because when you look at it from an evolutionary standpoint, it seems to be kind of self-defeating. Gay people aren't really reproducing effectively. So why are there still gay people? Well, part of that misunderstanding is that it's not like you're going to necessarily have gay children. In fact, if you're gay, I have seen no studies that show that you're more likely to have a gay child than a heterosexual one. Statistically, you're just more likely to have a heterosexual child. Now, we had the study last year that showed that, well, there isn't a gay gene. The process is much more complicated, and a lot has to go on for you to be gay. And we still haven't figured it all out yet. There's a new paper published by Duke University professor Brian Hare. The paper was published this month in Frontiers in Psychology, and it's titled Prosociality and a Social Sexual Hypothesis for the Evolution of Same-Sex Attraction in Humans. So, what do they mean by that? Well, their theory, in a nutshell, is that human sexuality, including homosexuality, evolved as an outcome of the evolution of increased sociability in humans. They believe that a lot of what guided our developing sexuality, gay or straight, was because human beings had to work so closely together, and that that was a bigger factor than just reproductive ability. And I misspoke. At this point, it's not really a theory. It's what they call the social sexual hypothesis. They talk about the bonobo, our closest primate relative. And straight and gay sex have vital roles in their play in social transactions and barter of food, same-sex social bonding between mating pairs. So we can see clearly that sexuality has evolved to serve a number of different functions within bonobo society. And is probably pretty much the same thing with humans. The authors of the study write, early humans that could quickly and easily access the benefits of group living had a strong selective advantage. We believe this led to the evolution of a whole range of traits, including reduced aggression, increased communication, understanding, social play, and affiliation. They continue, gay sex and attraction may have evolved because individuals with a degree of same-sex attraction benefited from greater social mobility, integration, and stronger same-sex social bonds. This may sound counterintuitive, they say, given that gay people are socially marginalized, ostracized, and even criminalized in many societies. However, their argument addresses the early evolution of human sexuality, not how recently sexuality has been impacted with things like religion and religion-based legal structures. They say that their hypothesis predicts that bisexuality and people who identify as mostly straight should be more common than people who identify as exclusively gay. This is certainly true. But as we step back and take a look at the big picture of sexuality in humans, what is always astonishing to me is the incredible diversity of sexual desire. That diversity, and not the limitations of those who are strictly straight and prefer sex in a very narrow, stereotypical way, but that diversity is what has allowed us to become the kinds of creatures that we are today. I've had to deal with the medical profession a lot. I've had my own major traumas, but I also have a friend with a tethered brainstem. And I took her to the doctor, I guess it was over a period of a couple of years, where she tried to get her initial diagnosis. She had all these symptoms. But the doctors did what they tend to do, and what I've experienced time and time again, especially if you're a woman, and studies have certainly shown this. When women complain about problems that the doctor cannot immediately identify or figure out what it is, it's very, very common to just say, oh, this is a psychological problem, and, you know, go get some behavioral therapy, and that'll fix it. Well, yeah, she was told that same thing. Behavioral therapy does not fix a tethered brainstem. And over the time that it took to get her diagnosed, her condition deteriorated significantly. And we should probably do a segment fairly soon about how the medical profession fails women, and in a lot of cases doesn't even bother to study them in studies that are limited to just male subjects, which skews the data all over the place. I've had doctors suggest behavioral therapy for conditions that I know, and certainly proved out, to have been physical. But once a doctor thinks something's all in your head, they do not want to let go of that diagnosis, because it takes the burden off of them. It's not their problem anymore. So they love telling people, oh, well, you know, this could be a psychological issue. It drives me nuts. Happens all the time. Doctors do tend to do this more commonly with women. And women's conditions, we should not forget that the number one diagnosis at the turn of the last century was hysteria, a condition which doesn't even exist. You know, that was the one where doctors would masturbate women to orgasm to cure it. And here's a really horrible condition known as RGS, a restless genital syndrome. And women have been told for years that this is just, you know, in their head. But it's a horrible, horrible condition. Your genitals and your clitoris are constantly aroused. It is not enjoyable. And we now know, more recently, that it's probably associated with restless leg syndrome. And while we use the term arousal, it's not pleasurable arousal. It's more discomfort. It's not like you're horny all the time. It's typically described as a burning or a numbness, a restlessness. It can present any time, but it's typically worse at night. It's pretty rare. About 1% of women around the world seem to be afflicted by it, and even fewer men. It's very rare in men. But it's probably also underdiagnosed. And in a recent article in the journal Pain, studies show that it's probably rooted in neurology, which makes sense. What causes it, we don't know. In a study, there were 10 women with the disorder, and they did find lesions on the base of the spine for all of them. Now, these lesions can trap nerves deep in the spinal cord, and if they're tied into sexual arousal, that could be RSG. In a 2009 study of women with RGS, they found that the majority of them also had restless leg syndrome. After many years of pretty much chalking this up to, you know, women's psychological issues, it's finally getting seriously studied. No cure yet,